Hi, this is Kim of Kim Turner LLC. Our mission is to provide immersive, relevant training and consulting for the next generation of 911. Our instructors and consultants are current industry leaders and practitioners with over 360 years of combined experience in the field or under the headset. We are results driven. So if you're ready to elevate your training personally, for your department, or for your region, look us up online, www.thekimturner.com. I look forward to hearing from you.
Imagine going to a funeral for a family member. You spend hours mourning the loss, and on the way home with your brother, he grabs his chest. Now imagine you're 911, answering the call of a man who is crying and pleading for you to help his brother. He's unable to get him out of the car to perform CPR, and he doesn't make it. This is what it's like within the trenches. In this episode, you will hear stories from the I Am 911 movement, a movement I started to fight the classification, rather the reclassification, of dispatchers from clerical to protective and bring awareness to the types of calls that 911 dispatchers answer on a daily basis. This is a live audience episode, and we are recording live from Las Vegas, Nevada, for the 2018 National APCO Conference. Now, you heard the warning in the beginning, but I must warn you again and add that if you suffer from PTSD or have suicidal tendencies, you are listening at your own risk. The stories you're about to hear are all true and come from the dispatchers who live them. While some stories have a good outcome, the majority are horrifying. This is our reality. Your worst day is our everyday. So let's start with a bang. I want you to imagine each story. Become the dispatcher who has taken each call and imagine listening. You were 8 years old and camping with your friends and their mother. Their parents were intoxicated, but you got in the car and left to head back down to go home. The car you were in rolled, struck a culvert, and you died almost instantly. We tried to do CPR with you, with no success. I snuck into your visitation to say I'm sorry, and I tried. I am 911. I'm going to tell you, like I said in the beginning, these are some emotional stories. I'm already getting there myself. So who's got a story? Who has a story they want to share? Just raise your hand and I will come over to you. Don't be afraid. We all come from the same place. Hold on one moment. Get her here really quick.
So in June of this year, I took a 911 call from a father who was very upset, screaming at me, telling me all the usual, get someone here now. Turns out that his son was down in the basement. His wife was performing CPR. His son had a probable accidental overdose. Son was a known drug user in our community. And our sergeant walked into the room as I'm still trying to get the father to calm down and help his wife perform CPR, and he told my partner something, which she told me after the call had ended, that the reason he headed to the residence was because this was the second son that the family had lost to drugs, and the husband had turned violent the last time, so our sergeant went there to try and keep the whole family together and calm in that moment, and it was the second time that the mother had to perform CPR on one of her sons. As far as I know, they have one son left.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing.
Mine was about 7-8 years ago now, but I was a fire dispatcher. We also answer phones on our fire dispatch channel. A grandma had called in to report that her less than a year old granddaughter was unconscious and not breathing. When I started to try to perform CPR, they stopped listening to me and just kept screaming, did you roll over on the baby? Did you roll over on the baby? She actually hung up on me 3 different times. got her back on the phone by the time the paramedics arrived on scene. Unfortunately, the baby did not make it.
Thank you.
In about November of last year, I was about a month clear from training and independent. I got a call from a mother who witnessed, she was calling me as she was witnessing her son stab his father to death. The screams that I heard from her are something I could never forget. Even watching the scariest movies, there's no comparison to that type of scream. But it kind of hardened me in such a way that nothing else has affected me like that before. I mean, watching your son kill your husband has to be horrible. There were about for a month, I drove past that house every day just because I couldn't get the screams out of my head, and I felt like that was the only way to get past it. He even posted on Snapchat. I watched that video as well. It was crazy.
Thank you for sharing. I have to ask really quick, driving past that place and seeing it and thinking about it and hearing it, it's going to sound weird. Did it help in any way to do that? It's because we don't get closure, right? We don't know. So I can imagine, you know, being you and passing by there. You know, I took a similar call on a suicidal subject who ran their car into the tree. And my closure was to see the pictures that the medical examiner had taken. Sounds crazy. It sounds weird. But it was someone who I tried to call as well. And as I was trying to call that person, another call was coming in, and nobody else could pick up the phone. So I hung up from trying to call this guy, and I pick up the phone, and it's a caller telling me that they just saw a car run right into a tree. And I could feel it. I just knew it was that guy, and it was. It was that guy. And it, for whatever reason, helped to see that. So that's why I ask if it helped at all. Who else had a story? There was an over here. There's a lot. Okay, there's one right in back of you. I'm going to try to get to everyone as I'm coming back and forth here.
Mine was a couple years back now. I'm a mother with three children. I think a lot of us are parents, and when we lose children, we often put our own children's faces on these kids, whether intentionally or unintentionally. And so a lot of how I parent is I parent in reaction to what not to do. So I think, well, I'll never drive drunk, so that's not going to be my kids. Or I think I'm never going to leave my kids near a pool or own a pool, so that won't be my kid. But this one day, this mom did everything perfect. She had three kids. I have three kids. And she had the two little boys hold hands and cross in the crosswalk in front of her. And she followed right behind, holding the hand of her little girl. And this woman was extremely impaired on drugs, and she ran them over, the two little boys right in front of the mom. And the mom was so close that the tire tread was on her toes of her shoes, but she couldn't get them. And the little boys were hit so hard they flew out of their shoes, and the shoes were left behind in the crosswalk. And she did everything right. So there was nothing I could look back on and say I would never be that mom. And I think that's why it hit me so hard. And it turns out that the woman who had hit them was a neighbor of mine. So I got to see her car, and I got to see her until the trial went forward. And I think that was one of the harder things, was to watch her walk around free on bail when this mom would never get her son back. The other son did live. And I didn't get closure until that boy that lived, who was holding his brother's hand when he died, called 911 because he was scared one morning because his parents had left to go see his brother's gravesite, and his aunt was supposed to take him to school, and she hadn't gotten there in time. So he called 911 for help, and I got to talk to him and let him know that we were here for him. And we sent officers out who took him to school, and we followed up with the family, and that was where my closure came from. And that was probably my hardest call.
One moment.
So one morning, 3 years ago in July, I went into work and took over from the supervisor that was on night shift going home, just like we did every shift change. Several hours later, we get a call from our neighboring county that needed our SWAT team to go assist with a situation that they were having. So, you know, we did what we normally do, you know, hey, what's going on, what's the location, and they give the address, and the dispatcher call taker that was on the phone with that neighboring county hung up the phone, and she said to me, I think this is her address, our employee's address. She had went home, and she was involved in a murder-suicide by her longtime boyfriend, fiance. And the neighboring, I don't know about, I'm sure that some of you guys are probably friends with some of your neighboring counties too, and we told them we think this is her. It was her house, and he shot her and then shot himself. Luckily, the girls weren't home, but she was one of us. Embodiment of I am 911. She was 911.
Thank you for sharing. Side. Yeah, just go.
So I'm going to start my story a little different than others. I joke when I present. My name is Tracy, and I work with Rapid SOS. And I joke that when I present, I'm a recovering PSAP director. I spent 20 years in the 911 center, and I left because I have PTSD. I share my PTSD story nationwide because I feel it's really important that we support each other and to tell folks that it's okay to not be okay. These calls that we hear, the things that we experience in the 911 center, it isn't for the faint of heart. One of the stories that sticks with me was when I was a baby dispatcher in 1998. It was Father's Day, and we had a clam bake for 450 people for our fire department. And at the end of the clam bake, I had to go on shift. So I worked the clam bake, went into dispatch. One of our firefighters' three-year-old son had come into dispatch with me, as most of the kids did. It was fun to be in there. And he sat on my lap and he colored. Everybody left the center. Left the station. About 2 hours later, I got a 911 call. It was at 5:15 p.m. for 515 North Avenue for a three-year-old that had drowned in the pool, and Dad was doing CPR. It was Christopher. He had just been on my lap. He had just been playing. And I just remember dispatching that call and being on the ceiling. My adrenaline was going so fast, I don't remember anything that I said. I don't remember anything that I heard until I heard his mom say, he's breathing on his own. It took 3 minutes to get first responders there. Christopher is here today. He's alive and well. But that is one of the calls that sits in the back of my head and always will. I'm 911.
I remember the screams vividly as a newer dispatcher as well. There was a language issue because there was about six adults in the house, a domestic situation between mom and dad. No one spoke English, and a little girl, she was 4 years old at the time, tried to defuse the situation, but unfortunately she got in the way when dad went to shoot mom, and she was the victim. I am 911.
So this was when I was a fairly new 911 dispatcher. Co-worker took a call and froze. We didn't know what the call was, so I took it over. It was a baby not breathing. The father was yelling and screaming, punching the wall. The mother was asking us to send help. We figured out that it was a baby not breathing, so we didn't have EMD. All we could do is we'll send everybody, which we did. I was unfortunately an EMT at the time, but I wasn't allowed to even tell them how to do CPR. And we got them there. Unfortunately, it was a SIDS, so there was really nothing to do. The baby was cold and blue. But what sticks in my mind to this day, and I still have nightmares over, is I had just recently did CPR on my own son, who was a baby, because he coded at home. I resuscitated him. So the two of them just really, really just, even today I still have nightmares. So I am 911.
Thank you for sharing. I want to get some people that are over here on this side.
This has been several years ago as well. We had a 911 dispatcher who had recently medically retired. About 3 months later, we take a call that her house is on fire. We don't put the address together right away, but within a few minutes of taking the call, we realize whose residence it is. Firefighters were there fighting the fire. We couldn't locate the communications officer. A little bit later, they found a suicide note at her brother's house, which is right down the street, that said we would find her at one of her favorite fishing spots. So us knowing her so well, we started sending our police officers to all her fishing spots, but we had gotten there too late. She had committed suicide.
March 18th, Fire Channel, 1442 in the afternoon. I took your call and you were not readable. I couldn't understand you. I kept asking questions about your location and finally recognized the street address, and you said you'd been cut. And you didn't know where. But you were 7 months pregnant, and the incision was to your belly, and the child had been removed and taken to the hospital by your perpetrator. You survived, and your baby didn't. My recovery from PTSD started with seeing her in the hospital. She's alive and well today, and my friend.
I'm a PSEP director. One day we had a new employee who, a newer employee who just finished training, who came off from, called in sick the night before, a little suspicious, but didn't think much of it. Our dispatcher takes a 911 call. It is a hang-up call. Says, please dispatch police and fire to, or police and EMS to such and such address for a suicide. Sets the phone down. And it's that employee. And the dispatcher did not recognize his voice, which wasn't his fault. He waited until the patrol arrived and then committed suicide over the phone. There's no reason, and it's one of those things that there's been no closure in our 911 center for.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for sharing.
I've had multiple people die on the phone with me, but the one that has stuck with me is one I just took, and I honestly forgot about it until my wife brought it up to me. She's a police officer, and she's like, oh, because we were in discussion with other people about, you know, what kind of calls have you ever taken? And I was like, I completely blanked it out. Like, and I've not, I mean, I wonder what other else I've blanked out. I took a 911 call. It was a Sunday morning. And it started out as a son, and then I spoke with the wife, and the wife was just in hysterics, and I finally got her calmed down and got the address, and, you know, she said, I woke up and I couldn't find my husband, and, you know, I went out to the shed, and he was in the shed, and I got her to calm down some more and tell me what she saw, not to touch anything. She's like, you know, I knew he'd been depressed, but I didn't know, and he had hung himself the night before. And at that same time, we had a chaplain who likes to visit our center on Sunday mornings. And I said, look, and he was our on-call chaplain. I said, give her a hug for me. You don't have to tell her it was me. Just give her, I really think she needs this hug. And so he did. And he came back to visit us later and gave me the hug back, saying, I told her that this was from the lady you spoke with on the phone. it just really, because I'm really big on mental health in the center, being, you know, a person who's been struggling with mental health all my life, it just struck me that this was one that I blanked out. You know, I'm like, what else have I blanked out? You know, people ask me, how was your day? Well, I don't know. It was a day. What was my day? I've been doing it for 14 years. And so it makes me wonder how many others of us also blank out.
A couple months ago, I took a call from a male who stated that his wife was choking. I was on the phone with him for 4.5 minutes. In that 4.5 minutes, I asked approximately 4 times if she was breathing. He said she was each and every time. He offered her food, water, but she didn't say anything. Medics got on scene and called time immediately. She was having end-of-life breaths that mimicked breathing, and she had a DNR, so there was nothing that they could do to help her. But they said that she was dead immediately on scene. And I had to have the medics call in and tell me what happened because I felt like I had done something wrong, even though I asked and asked and asked and asked. There was no indication that something was actually, that she was dead, but she had died. And I felt like I had done something wrong, and I had to have someone else tell me I didn't. It was probably one of the worst things for me, because I felt like I didn't do my job right.
I think that's something that happens more often, that we beat up ourselves about that.
May 25th of this year, we had just actually finished as a group in the dispatch center reviewing our active assailant protocol. About 9 o'clock that morning, a dispatcher that I work with yelled across the room, active shooter in Indiana, where I'm from. I did not take the initial call, but I talked to the vice principal on the second call, and that's the only time I can remember in my life not being able to physically use my hands because my adrenaline was pumping so bad. And then I think just the calls from the students and the parents that you take in utter desperation, wanting to know information. And at that same time, we had got a copycat threat at the high school in that same town. And so we had students calling in about that and parents as well. Fortunately, we did get some closure due to the heroic acts of a teacher there at that school. Only one student was injured in that. Student actually made it back to the first day of school this last week. So I haven't thought about it much since today, actually. So kind of happy to share that.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing.
About 12 years ago, when I was fresh out of training and released on my own, a man was posting suicidal comments on the internet. And we started getting phone calls from his family and friends. So we dispatched officers to check his welfare. And he met the officers on the front porch. And after some discussion, he had assured them that he was not suicidal. And so they cleared the scene. And shortly after that, we got more calls from his friends and family saying that the suicidal comments were continuing online. So as a brand new dispatcher, I, you know, checked with my coworkers to get their feedback of whether we should go out again or not. And they said, you know what, you're the lead dispatch on this, and you need to make that decision. And you're not going to be right or wrong either way. But there's judgment calls to be made, and this is your turn. Well, I decided to err on the side of caution, and we went back out there, and he had run a line from his car in the garage up to his bedroom, and he barely had a pulse when the officers found him. And it was just a big lesson to me that the weight of the responsibility and our judgment early on, I learned that. And later that night, one of the officers that had gone to the hospital with them came into dispatch, and I asked how he was, and I was feeling pretty good about my decision. But the officer let me know that when he came to, he was very unhappy to find that he was still alive. And so that busted my bubble and was just another lesson learned that you can't really take that responsibility and watch somebody and take that on yourself 24/7 because they're going to do what they're going to do. But
we also had an active shooter at a community college in our city, and it wasn't just the one phone call, it was the continual phone calls. The phones just lit up, and we had calls from people at the school saying, I'm in the bookstore with 30 people, I'm in the cafeteria with 20 people, we just started asking people, okay, what room are you in and how many people are with you? What room are you in and how many people are with you? And then in the middle of all those calls, we were getting calls from parents. My son just texted me, my daughter just called me, somebody just sent me an email. So we had parents saying, my son's in room this, my son's in the gym, my daughter is here. So we were getting inundated with calls, everybody worried, saying, I'm stuck in here, I can't get out. And parents saying, my children are stuck in there, they can't get out. And we couldn't send anybody in until we knew where the guy was. So it ended up being a murder-suicide thing. He shot the girl and then shot himself. But we had to clear the entire school because we didn't know how many shooters there were, because we had reports of two at one point in time. So it took a really long time to get in to be able to get everybody out, and the phone calls continued the whole time because the people inside the school were still petrified and the parents still couldn't get in touch with everybody. So that continued for a really long time, so it kept your adrenaline up for a really long time. So the letdown from that, you know, when your adrenaline gets so high, the letdown from that, you just like crash, and then you still have to continue your day. And in the middle of all those phone calls, we were still getting normal phone calls. So somebody would say, oh, yeah, I need to do a few test calls. Really, right now, it's not the time to do some test calls. So, I mean, even when you're working a high-stress incident, nothing else stops. Your whole day continues. So that is hard to deal with as well.
So I used to coach my niece's softball team since the age she was 5. And we had always had the same girls typically on the team clear until they reached the age of 8U. I had received a call one day from a male subject. I recognized his voice instantly, and he was threatening suicide with a firearm. So continued to talk to him, not letting him know that it was me because I knew him. He knew me, and I had been his daughter's softball coach since she was 5. Just before officers arrived on scene, he had shot himself, and he did not make it. I ended up going to the funeral, and I still have yet to tell his daughter and his wife that I still see every year at the softball fields that it was me that took the phone call from their father and her husband.
As many of us usually take, we all take those 911 hang-ups. This time I'd taken a 911 hang-up from one of our local cities. I called it back, as protocol says, and a man picked up the phone. He was out of breath and asked the general questions, is everybody okay? Is everybody fine? And he was like, oh yes, no problems, no problems whatsoever. I didn't hear anything in the background that a normal person wouldn't say, okay, and just hang up the phone. But the fact that he was out of breath and he was so quick to answer my questions, I got concerned. So I sent the call, and the sergeant on duty said, I don't know why we're going to this. I said, something doesn't feel right. And we convinced him to go out, which was a little hard at that time because he was sure I didn't know what I was talking about. Got out there, and he found him, the male subject, they called me, beating his wife's head into the kitchen sink. And immediately screamed for backup on the other side, and she turned out to make it. Had we not went ahead with the call, she wouldn't have made it. And that's the first thing I asked for was a phone call, because I wanted to know why they were screaming for backup. And he says, because he was beating her head into the kitchen sink when they got there.
Thank you very much.
I just want to start off by saying in July of last year, I was 8 months pregnant, and I lost my son. And that was in July, and then of April of this year, I took a 911 call from a woman, she was 22, and she called 911. She was crying. She sounded to be a little bit upset. She said that she had had a sharp pain in her stomach, and she passed out. And when she woke up, she had given birth to a baby that she didn't even know that she was pregnant with. And it was blue and cold, and she was trying to do CPR on it. Having just lost my son, I felt really strongly for this mother. And after I took the 911 call, gave her over to the ambulance, I went outside and I cried for probably 20, 30 minutes before I could get composure to come back in. I found out like a couple hours later that when the agents and everybody got out there, there was not just one baby, there were two. And she did know she was pregnant, and she was full term with the babies, and she had killed them both. And she gave birth to them on the toilet. She put one of them outside in the trash can and covered it with cat litter and all the evidence. And it took me so long to be able to deal with that after everything, because it's so hard not to feel for these people that call in, and you have no idea if they're telling you the truth or if they're just like this woman. I felt so bad, and my gut hurt for her, my heart hurt for her, and it's the thing that nobody as a dispatcher even thinks that you would deal with on the job every day, to have something hit so close to home and then get so angry immediately after. It's horrible.
I'll try to make it quick. She was on 911 when she was shot and killed. I basically took a 45-minute call with the husband as he held her while she bled to death before EMS and everyone arrived. And I played the incident over and over and over. We got subpoenaed to court. I was extremely nervous, not wanting to see the family, the suspect. But at the end of it, suspect took plea agreement. I'm 911, 14 years.
Thank you for sharing.
I had just gotten off training. I still consider myself a training baby when I took the call. It started off with that tragic, heartbroken screaming that doesn't go away. And that was in the background. And I talked to a man who had said that he and his wife had come to meet their son. And their son had hung himself. He was 24 years old. He's 2 years younger than I was at the time that I took the call. And I just kept thinking about my parents. So my parents live right down the street from me. And that was something that I still can't get out of my head.
Thank you for sharing.
Well, I'm the PSEP director for a well-known university in the nation, and we take several calls. And I guess the thing that rings home to me is most people think when their kids go to school, they get into college, they've done their job. The hard part is over. But I'll never forget a Sunday morning. A few years ago, we took a call where a young man was very frantic. Basically, what happened was his ex-girlfriend had broken into his house and saw him with another female and then ran out crying. So the reason why they had broke up was because he felt she was too attached. So we sent officers to that location. On the way there, we started receiving several calls of a woman standing on a bridge. Now, we then diverted other officers as well as EMS there to that location we were receiving calls for, but by the time they got there, she had already jumped. Now, that young man, he never graduated. He dropped out because he never got over the fact that she basically took her life because of him. And I'll be honest with you, I remember driving in that morning. Like I said, it was a Sunday, it was I remember what it was like. I remember what I ate that morning for breakfast.
So this one hits really close to home for me because I have a dad that's a deputy, and he's been one for 28 years. And my uncle is also a deputy, and he's probably been doing this for a decade. We took a call from a deputy's wife telling us that he was missing. Earlier that day, he had gone home earlier than he normally did, and we didn't know the circumstances, and nobody really questioned it. And so they kind of left dispatch in the dark and didn't tell us what was going on, but we knew something was wrong. They had a full search party, including state police and multiple different agencies. And about 24 hours later, they found him in a field and he had shot himself in the head. And it made our whole dispatch center fall apart, and we still have a hard time dealing with it. And as my job, I'm the quality assurance coordinator. I'm supposed to review everything, and hearing his voice is heartbreaking. I am 911.
This happened not too long ago. I'm from a small county, and we're close with the counties around. Me and my supervisor were getting multiple 911 calls about a vehicle driving in northbound in the southbound lane. It was 2 miles just south of our county. This is a call I can't get over. That vehicle hit an off-duty police officer from the county over with him and his pregnant wife, and he died on scene.
Thank you very, very much.
Those are just a few stories from Imagine Listening, an extension of the podcast featuring the stories of the I Am 911 movement. You know, there was a second session on Monday, and 93 911 professionals packed the room. This session, unfortunately, it wasn't recorded, but three stories were written down and handed to me. I was in the room when you dialed 911. I immediately recognized the number. I heard you say the words I will never forget. My son's not breathing. He's dead. Your son, my best friend of 25 years. I am 911. I'm the one you called when your wife wouldn't stop stabbing herself. I tried to send help as quickly as I could. The drugs were too much. She couldn't stop tearing her flesh apart, both with the knife and with her teeth. I can only imagine what you had to see. I only had to hear it all unfold. I am 911. It was the morning immediately after October 1st. You called in, and I didn't get to finish my phone greeting before you started screaming. You screamed how it was all my fault. It was my fault your precious baby died. How I should be dead and not your daughter. You screamed how I was just as much a murderer as the man who pulled the trigger. You screamed at me for 10 minutes, and I didn't stop you. After you hung up, I didn't cry. But I realized I never learned your name or your daughter's name. I didn't cry until I got home. And I cry every time I look at the faces of the 58 people who died. And I wonder, which one was your daughter? I am 911. There was one more story that I remember, actually. And specifically, I remember the ending of it. There was a buildup, of course. The dispatcher telling the story was strong. But others, including myself, were emotional while listening. The last part, though, I'll never forget. She said, "You are the reason I am 911. I love you, Dad." There was a gasp in the entire room. It's hard to explain. It took me a minute. I stood there biting my lip before I gave her her coin and thanked her for sharing the story. And I thank all of you for sharing. And as for the rest of the stories that were told during that session, I truly believe that those were meant for just us in that moment of time. So thank you. Imagine Listening has become a sought-after session. And because of that, I can say that I'm on tour. An Imagine Listening tour. I'll be traveling to conferences through next year. I'll be doing the podcast, keynote speeches, and of course, Imagine Listening. There'll be plenty of opportunity for you to earn an official I Am 911 Challenge coin. So today is August 24th, 2018. I Am 911 Day. The movement has grown and evolved and continues to do so. But it begs the question, what's next? We will continue to share stories. All of them. And be the voice and outlet for dispatchers all over the world to share their dispatch experience. But there is also partnership. Partnership in those who handle what happens after we find relief in sharing our stories. Partnership in those who can help us manage the stress that comes with the calling of being a 911 dispatcher. So in the coming weeks, you will see more and more partnerships. And while we take the torch to help share these stories, they will have our back and help us manage the hell that can plague us within the trenches of 911. Thank you all again for the support, and here's to many more years of I Am 911. The movement continues.